Hello, and welcome to the fourth night of Millennial 2020. I have four streams coming up tonight. Next up is, let me see, The Great Order, then Semiogog, and then Robin Riley. But first, it's my old friend, the Franklin, the cultural commentator formerly known as Reactionary Expat. And but before we get into that, it occurred to me that I really should have been at the start of each night, I should have been explaining my t-shirts because some people have been asking. So let me explain that the first night it was an Escape from New York t-shirt. Then the second night it was a RoboCop t-shirt. And then the third night it was Blake Seven. And then tonight it's The Shining. So let me just display this fantastic design for you all. Isn't that cool? And you can get these from, I think it's called redbubble.com. So there you go. I hope they appreciate the little product placement there. All right. So yeah, very cool stuff. I mean, if you're into that kind of thing, which, you know, maybe we shouldn't be, but still, it's a guilty pleasure. All right, now down to business. So the Franklin, I'll just say Franklin.
Sure.
Welcome back to Millennial, and thank you very much for appearing. You're always a popular request. And of course, you and I have known each other for
So,
2012.
yeah,
So
yeah, 8 years.
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it is. It's 8 years now. Bloody hell.
Yeah.
So
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Would you like to just tell people briefly about your own channel so that I mean, it's there to click on in the description, but go for it anyway.
Sure. So I live in Australia, and I talk a bit about Australian things, but mostly international topics, sort of cultural commentary and that sort of thing. I'm fairly cynical about life in the West. So I lived abroad for many years, over a decade actually, in East Asia, and I returned to Australia a couple of years ago, and I've been dealing with some fairly severe culture shock ever since, and just shaking my head at the state of this place. It's quite disconcerting, actually. Yeah, so I just comment on that kind of stuff. Occasionally, I talk about some other things like economics or homeschooling my children, or I don't really post videos about this stuff because I'm worried about doxing myself. But I'm into sort of permaculture and self-sufficiency and that kind of stuff. So I talk about that. I don't really show anything of that, though. Yeah, so that's kind of an introduction.
All right, and do go and subscribe to his channel because this is it's a really good. He's one of the best people I know, honestly. So
Thanks.
give him a subscription. I'm not just saying that. I wouldn't just say that. All right, so we're going to talk about the two really hot issues this year, COVID and the U.S. election, and we're going to try to talk about these issues in a way that is YouTube friendly. Well, let's go for it then. Let's return to January, and there were rumors. Did it start in December last year, or was it January? I mean, obviously it started in December. Then the US government knew about COVID. I mean, that's why it's COVID 19, because it's 2019, I believe. That's how it came about. They knew about it then, but I don't think we knew about it until sometime in January. And
Yeah, I think that's right.
Take us back to then. And you want to talk about how this has been mishandled and so on, just to let people know. So
Yeah,
let
yeah.
okay.
Sorry.
Let's go back to the start.
Well, the big takeaway for me from 2020 is just how the West has been revealed to be a real paper tiger.
Yeah,
So
but let's start at the start, 'cause I want to hear your perception of COVID-19 as it unfolded.
well, I think I have an interesting perspective because I actually went to Asia in February. So as I said, I lived in Taiwan for over 10 years and I came back a couple of years ago. So at the beginning of this year, I was kind of aware of what was going on over there. And I was getting a different perspective as well because I had access to the news media over there. So at the same time as Taiwan shut its flights and all that kind of stuff from Chinatown pretty quickly, and there was a fair bit of concern over that. So when I went to Taiwan, I met with a guy there who's a businessman, and he has factories in China. There are a lot of factories in China that are Taiwanese, and something like a million people out of 23 million live over there and work over there and so on. And he said that initially his factories had, or his business had taken a 40% hit because of having to shut these factories down in China and so on. But Taiwan got onto this very quickly. They shut their borders with China, and they were very good at testing and tracing, such that even to this day, they've only had 7 deaths from this. And the last death was in May, if I remember correctly. And that's with a population that's pretty old. They're one of the oldest populations in the world, high density living, all of that kind of stuff.
That's absolutely incredible that they've only had 7 deaths from this entire, in the entire span of it. Could that be to due to genetics?
I don't know.
I'm saying that these things matter, obviously, but could there be a genetic predisposition to, or what, negative predisposition, whatever that is?
Not necessarily. I mean, the one Western nation that's really performed well is New Zealand, and I think, if I remember correctly, they've only had 25 deaths. Now, it helps being an island, obviously, in the case of both New Zealand and Taiwan. But in both cases, they got onto it pretty quickly. They shut down the borders, and they're pretty strict about testing and tracing. So as all of that was happening, as Taiwan really got onto it very quickly, the only things that I could really see in the Australian media were, this is a right-wing racist conspiracy theory against Chinese people, and you should go down to Chinatown during Chinese New Year and hug a Chinaman, that kind of thing. Then I went to, pardon me, then I went to,
I just want to say that this is to remind people of what it was actually like at the start of this.
Yeah.
First of all, there was the jokes and about bat soup, which I took part in because I genuinely did find it all quite hilarious at the time. It was just the very idea of, you know, the stuff being discovered, like the dirty secret of the Chinese is that they do this kind of thing, you know? It was funny. And everyone was laughing about it. And then the reaction from the mainstream was, don't say the China virus, which I did think was a kind of stupid expression to use, to be honest. It was one of those Sivnat attempts to be edgy. And look at me goading the left. Look at me triggering the libs by calling it the China virus. It's just silly. But also, the reaction from the mainstream was, don't call it the China virus. And it's also just a racist slur against, like, the whole thing is just a racist thing against the Chinese. The virus is it's not a big deal. And you should be risking. I mean, this was the thing in Italy that they were saying, go and hug a Chinese person. And then a few weeks after, or like less than a week after that.
I think Nancy Pelosi in the US said that as well.
Yeah, I think so, but I think she did. That rings a bell. But I think it specifically happened in Italy, and then a bunch of people died, like old people, died from it, like within a week of that that advice being put out that you should go and hug it, just to show how unracist you are and how open-minded you are and how unafraid you are of the virus. That was one aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it was, well, we can't do something that would damage the economy. You know, we can't shut down the trade and travel, tourism, because it's essential that the economy keeps going. At the time, I remember finding quite mercenary and sick. But now, I feel quite the opposite. So, sorry, just wanted to recap about how it actually was at the start, because it's completely different from what we've been seeing for the last 9 months.
Yeah, well then, so I went to Taiwan. I had to go over there for business. And the procedures of getting through the airport and so on were a lot stricter than before. It took an extra hour to get through the airport. But once I got out of the airport into general society, nothing much had changed. The only thing that was different was because they'd shut down all these flights from China, there weren't masses of Chinese tourists. So, for instance, I went to the National Palace Museum, which is the sort of big museum in Taipei, and it was pretty empty. which was good. That's why I went there, because I knew I wouldn't have to contend with millions of Chinese tourists. But otherwise, everything was normal. People were at restaurants, they were taking trains, all of that kind of stuff. Then I returned to Australia, and it was the quickest I've ever been through the airport. I was shocked, actually, at how quickly I got through the airport. There were no procedures for testing people or anything like that. And this was, by this point, this was late February, and Italy was already melting down. Iran was already melting down, and China had already melted down. And I was sitting in the sort of lobby, the arrivals lounge, waiting for my father and my wife to come to pick me up. And there were all these guys coming through. They were clearly Central Asian. And I was thinking, you know, Iran is in the midst of melting down. And I figure if someone is going to fly from Central Asia to Australia, they probably need to go through one of a handful of places, one of which would probably be Tehran in Iran. I thought, yeah, these guys could actually have been in Iran a week ago. And because of the way we sort of do our globalism, we're not going to take that into account. We're just going to have this free-for-all, and all these guys are coming into the country. Nobody has any idea what's happening here, despite the fact that there are several other countries that are in pretty severe trouble at the moment, such as Italy. And then I went to, I had a number of conversations and so on, and I'm a sort of a minor prepper, and I'd already had a lot of stuff from last year anyway, prior to all of this. But I thought, I'll just go and get some extra stuff. So I went to Costco in Melbourne. I don't live in Melbourne. I live in rural Victoria. So I went to Melbourne, and I went to Costco, and I had all this stuff. And people were actually saying, wow, look at this guy. Yeah, he thinks the world's going to end. Fast forward 2 weeks, and on the news, there's all this footage of people having fist fights over toilet rolls. So, and that's when it turned. It went from everyone was blissfully unaware or making fun about it or sort of saying it's a racist conspiracy theory to the whole thing just melted down within about 2 weeks of me being back, and everyone was freaking out. Nobody knew what was going on. And then, of course, we saw it start to unfold in various Western nations after that. And here in Victoria, we had a pretty big second wave. And then, of course, the government, the state government, had to bring in these sort of draconian measures that were sort of not effective, I think, anyway. I mean, out here in the countryside, we had a very low number of cases, but we had all these draconian measures anyway. So,
from afar, it seemed absolutely insane what was going on in Victoria and people being arrested for disagreeing.
Yeah. And at the same time that all of this was happening, my wife was getting telephone calls from her relatives and friends saying, are you okay? And she said, yeah, I'm fine. Why? What's going on? And they said, because all we can see on the news is people fighting for toilet rolls and these huge unemployment queues of unemployed baristas and things like that. So in Taiwan, the sort of the only news that they're getting of the West, or were getting of the West, was that everything's melting down. Meanwhile, everything's sort of okay in these other places.
So by that time, East Asia had basically had done the work in combating it, and we're now on the road to recovery before the fight back had even started in the West and in Western countries like Australia.
Yeah.
And then they went insane with it.
Yeah. And then, of course, in the middle of the year, we were treated to the sort of everything's on fire show in the USA. And it just sort of devolved from there, you know, and then the third world election in November, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And my general thesis is that these places such as developed Asia must be looking at the West now and laughing their asses off. And for instance, China, I think that regardless of whether China did this deliberately or not or any of those kinds of things, if I were high up in the Chinese government, I'd be saying, wow, this was an interesting war simulation that we ran, and countries like Australia, for instance, performed terribly. And there was all
well,
that.
Let's go into how they performed terribly before we get to the US election, which is a different matter. What was done badly in the West, including Australia?
Well, for instance, look at the thing with masks. So initially, masks weren't meant to be the thing. They weren't effective. We shouldn't be wasting the PPE that medical staff should have had and so on. That was the narrative very early on. And I think that's just because the West got caught without adequate supplies. And I'd be surprised if a lot of these things would have improved. And another interesting thing, one of my subscribers who's a farmer, he said he had real difficulty accessing agricultural chemicals. And so for instance, in Australia, the government likes to throw around this number that we produce three times as much food as we need in this country, and yet we're entirely dependent upon agricultural chemicals, which are made in China. And so all of these things...
God, I mean, it's just unbelievable. It was like in Britain at the time, they were saying that, you know, we need drugs, but we don't produce the drugs. We're reliant on drug manufacturing in China.
Yeah,
I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah, well, that's why I say that even if, regardless of whether China did this deliberately or not, this has revealed all sorts of weaknesses in the West. And if I were them, the lesson I'd be taking from this is, wow, there's a really interesting war simulation. If we had a war right now, these countries would be brought to their knees in 5 minutes. And I'm not really convinced that the West has done very much to alleviate these problems.
But before we get to that, what are the problems? What are the failings in the West's response to COVID-19?
Well, they didn't take it seriously to begin with. If they had shut down borders much more quickly, but of course they wouldn't have done that because that doesn't gel with their whole sort of internationalist agenda. And even now I see all these articles about how the road forward will be immigration. We need these people. And for instance, in Australia, we've actually had problems with agricultural harvests because of the lack of migrant workers. For instance, in the first week of everything sort of going to hell here, there were 88,000 baristas who were unemployed, and they needed 70,000 agricultural workers, but they couldn't fill those agricultural jobs, and they still can't. In fact, recently they've brought in migrant workers from the Pacific, from Vanuatu and so on. And so, we've got this weird situation where they...
Why do you think that is? Obviously the government's incompetence is part of it, but is it also because these baristas... Sorry, how is it pronounced? Is it barista or barista? I never know.
So I don't know.
Barista. Yeah. Okay, we'll just go with that. Is it because they are middle-class hipster people in their 20s, probably their 30s, who expect a sort of middle-class job, and they don't like the idea of working on the land? I mean, it seems to me that part of post-capitalism, post-industrial society was that everyone becomes middle class, and or they think they are going to, and so then the idea of working on the land just seems kind of beneath. Oh well, don't worry, we've got third world migrants who can do that. Do you think I'm correct about that?
A lot of that labor is done by third world migrants. A lot of it's actually done by backpackers as well. So European backpackers come over to Australia and travel around Australia for a year, and they...
There are some middle class types who do it. Okay.
Germans and Dutch and so on. Yeah, backpackers. But as for Australians, yeah, they don't do it. I think part of it is because they think it's beneath them. Part of it is because by the nature of the job, you have to move around a lot. So you follow the harvests. So there are different things in different parts of the, you know, it's a big country, different things in different parts of the country at different times of the year. So you have to move around following the harvest. It's hard work, you know. I mean, a lot of it, if given the choice, I wouldn't do it either. The point is that maybe they shouldn't have that choice because the government threw a whole lot of money at people. Maybe they should have made that contingent upon them doing certain things, but they didn't. And that's from a supposedly right-wing government. Also, some of the conditions are exploitative. There have been some notable cases of exploitation from farmers. That's not to say that every farmer is like that, but there is perhaps somewhat of a perception like that.
Nafald.
Yeah. I think it's a combination of factors. But to answer your original question, the countries that seem to have done this well seem to have done two things. One is that they took it seriously early on, because if you shut down the borders when you only have a half a dozen cases, it's very easy to get on top of those half a dozen cases. If you wait till you have 600 cases, it's significantly harder. So getting in early is a big part of the solution. And another part of it, I think, is just the medical system, at least in Australia, what I've found over the past couple of years across a number of situations has been that it's very bureaucratic. And, of course, the people in the medical system like to talk about how wonderful they are, but I find them to be very inefficient in the way that they do things. So this seems to be a problem across multiple domains, not just the medical system. There's a lot of money thrown at things. There are a lot of people who talk about how wonderful they are, but they don't actually get the results. They're very inefficient about this. The countries that seem to have done this well have been very efficient at detecting cases and then tracing the contacts of those cases and then getting on top of that very quickly, which just doesn't seem to have been the case here. And actually in Victoria, the big second wave actually began because of this completely farcical situation with hotel quarantine. So there was still so back in April and May, they said, right, go back to Australia if you're overseas. But ever since, we've had this kind of trickle of people coming back, and they put a whole lot of people into hotel quarantine, and it was badly handled by private security firms. And in some cases, supposedly the security guards were having sex with the people in quarantine. And the whole thing was just this farcical situation that unfolded. Now, that kind of thing obviously just didn't happen in those other places. But this is the this is sort of what we get. We get this kind of anarcho-tyranny where the government big notes itself, it's very good at advertising itself, throwing money around, swanning around, sort of talking a big talk. But when it actually comes down to it, they're grossly inefficient, and they'll sort of pick on someone walking their dog in a park by themselves. But then this whole hotel quarantine thing will get out of hand.
I remember in the north of England, there were police who deliberately, that there was some nice pond that people liked going to, and the police flooded it with some kind of ink, some sort of black ink, so that it would be less, so that it would be ugly, so that people wouldn't want to go there anymore, just for to stop them from going for walks in public.
Yeah. It's and yet there were probably other situations where they did. Well, okay. So when was it? I think it was early March. I think it was the 8th of March, actually. Italy was melting down, and the Spanish government, in its infinite wisdom, decided that the most important thing that it needed to do was have a giant women's march. Then yeah. We were told Donald Trump rallies are super spreader events. Oh, but actually, we need to have Black Lives Matter rallies. And they actually, some people actually came out and said, because racism is more of a problem than COVID, it will kill more people. And it was just...
And then, of course...
What's your narrative, you know?
anti-lockdown marches as well. Anti-lockdown demos are terrible, but because they're dangerous, spreading the disease. But BLM protest demos are fine.
In fact, we had that here. So in Melbourne, there was one of those anti-lockdown protests, and I think they're fairly futile. I think that actually just sort of reinforces the anti-fragility of the system. Because they love these kinds of things, and they can say, look at these loons, they're the problem, we told you. But anyway, so they had one of these marches, and there were 200 people or something in the city, and it was like, oh, these people. Fast forward, it was only 1 or 2 weeks, and that's when that whole Black Lives Matter thing took off. And of course, that had to happen everywhere else in the world as well. And there were 10,000 people in the city. So 200 anti-lockdown protesters bad, 10,000 Black Lives Matter protesters good. You know, it's really joyous.
It's completely nuts. Stuff, you know. Oh yeah. It's you're asked to. I mean, that's the thing. I think that the threat is something that people have to choose to believe in, because the evidence of it is not immediately. It's not apparent. So people choose whether to, like, because there aren't droves of people dying. I still, to this day, do not know anyone who has died from COVID-19. I know a couple of people who might have had it. That's it. Just a couple. And I think this is quite a typical experience of it. So there just doesn't feel like much of a threat. Like, to normal people, I'm not saying that there isn't a threat. I'm just saying that there doesn't seem to be. There doesn't feel like there's a threat. I'm guessing that when the Black Plague was active, people were aware of it. There's probably the Spanish flu. The Spanish flu and so on. I think people would have been, they'd have felt it in their bones. This is a fucking dangerous time that we're living in right now. All of us have got to be careful. Whereas with this, it feels largely like, well, I'll decide to believe that it's true. I'll decide to believe that we're all in danger. I'll decide to believe that those people who don't wear a mask are endangering the rest of us, because I want to believe that. In the same way that I want to believe that, you know, people who drive big cars are endangering the climate, causing climate change, and so on. It's a virtue signaling thing. I mean, we all know about virtue signaling. I'm not going to go into how. Isn't it strange that people virtue signal? Of course they do. I know it's fact of life. But it's just interesting to me that this has been something that's been manufactured so quickly and in the face of so much contrary evidence. I mean, the fact that a BLM march, that the establishment tells us that's just fine. I mean, how can
and doctors saying racism will kill more people than COVID, and a lot of this is sort of the old kind of Soviet thing that, for instance, I'll give you an analogy. So if I have a coffee mug and I say to you, oh, this is a teacup, if you insist, no, it's a teacup, there's some ambiguity there, and so that's not how totalitarianism works. What happens is I'm holding a coffee cup and you say that's a fork, and I said, obviously it's a coffee cup, and the whole reason you say it's something like a fork is because obviously it's not. But if you have the power to insist that I call it a fork, that's where the real power is revealed. Whereas if it's sort of we're quibbling over, is it a coffee cup, is it a teacup,
then by insisting that it's something similar to what it is, I'm not exerting power over you. It has to obviously be a lie.
And so this whole thing with like Black Lives Matter, for instance, in the Mood Treater 2, you know, they're 93% peaceful, and just this Orwellian nonsense, the degree to which people have had to suspend disbelief this year, the US election and so on, that in any other time or place would have been considered extremely dubious. This then creates a self-reinforcing, self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you live in a place where the government doesn't really appear to be lying to you and you think you can trust them, like they're fairly trustworthy, then you are actually going to go, you are going to wear a mask because you'll feel it's a sort of a sense of duty and everyone else. We are actually in this together. That's another thing. Look at the sort of slogans they've brought out and basically believe the other, the complete opposite. So, you know, we're all in this together. Actually, no, we're not. That sort of thing. But if you live in a place where the government isn't lying to you, then you're going to do these things anyway, and as a result, you're going to get better outcomes. Whereas if you live in a place that's draconian, where they're obviously lying to you, if you can, you're going to resist that, and then that's possibly going to lead to worse outcomes anyway, and then they're going to use those to justify more draconian measures. And so you get caught in a vicious cycle where the bad results justify the bad things that lead to the bad results. And
yes,
it's a downward spiral at that point. And that's a large part of what has happened in the West this year. Anyone who's even remotely critical would look at these things, the entire response to COVID, the Black Lives Matter and the Antifa and protests and riots and looting and all of that stuff, the US election, and say, you know, is this clown world? Whereas if you live in a place where the government basically doesn't hate you, then you can go along pretty well and everyone can go about their daily business, which is why my wife is getting phone calls from her friends saying, are you okay? Because they're still getting the sort of everything in the West is burning show on TV, whereas over there they're just catching the train and going to work and going to restaurants and all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I saw some footage. Apparently it was from Wuhan in China, and it was about a month ago now. And I don't know for sure that it was from Wuhan, but that's what I was told. That's what it said. And they were just, it was back to normal. I mean, there were some people wearing masks, but only a few. And it was like a crowd of people. I think it was the start of the Christmas shopping season sort of thing. I can't remember what it was, but anyway, it was a crowded place. And that's just normal now. You know, they're basically back to normal, if that footage was accurate. And that's what I've heard from other places.
Well, I mean, I was in Taiwan, so I can say this from personal experience. I've seen it. As I said, the only things that were different were tourist places, like the National Palace Museum. But restaurants were full of people. I went to probably a dozen restaurants in a week and a half when I was there. Trains still had lots of people commuting to work and school and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, you can't avoid it there because the population density is so high. So yeah, I've seen it firsthand that they got this under control. And for them, it's, and from their perspective, it must be really weird because for a long time, the West has been sort of the model for everyone else. And they must be looking at this now and really scratching their heads and thinking, what's going on?
Before we get to that, let's now move on to the US election. So that, because that is obviously the other big weird thing this year. Well, we could talk about BLM, which is in itself a thing.
Oh, yeah, you know, the iconoclasm and all of that sort of stuff was surreal in the West this year.
It was very disturbing.
I mean, they didn't just throw it. They had to roll it down the street, that statue in Bristol.
Yeah.
They had to roll it down the street. I mean, it wasn't just sort of, you know, 3 meters from where the statue was. And then they threw it in the river.
It was very disturbing. I mean, the destruction of these old things, and which have been meaningful for literally generations and generations of people. I mean, it's always been there in that city or in that town, wherever we're talking about. And suddenly all of it is, it's a bunch of sitting ducks. It's just a bunch of things to be destroyed, just waiting for their turn for some vandal to notice that one and destroy it. And I remember there was also some, and probably the most appalling thing connected to the BLM stuff this year was this awful harridan, this awful witch who was working in some museum.
Forgotten
where it was. She was an American woman. I won't be any more specific than just to say that she was an American woman, but she was working in Britain in a museum, and she was basically advising, here's what to do in order to cause permanent irreversible damage to statues. This is someone working in our heritage sector who's advising people on how to effectively destroy heritage.
I know. I thought that too. That was atrocious.
I mean, this is dystopian stuff. Yeah, this is.
Yeah, look, I'm old enough to remember when the Taliban blew up those Buddhist statues in Afghanistan in, I think it was 2000 or 2001, and the world offered to send teams of archaeologists and art historians and so on to cut them out of the cliffs and take them away, and the Taliban said no and dynamited them anyway. And these people are now the equivalent of the Taliban or ISIS.
I mean, everyone was shocked at that at the time, but now we're doing it to our own statues, our own heritage, and it's astounding. Again, it shows you how malleable the public are, and it's not just the virtue signaling leftists. It's everyone, because everyone else went along with that. I mean, everybody in the public at large went along with the destruction of statues. So it's a disturbing illustration of that. You know, you can get people to basically go along with anything.
Yeah, and then the election. And look, I'm no expert on this. I've sort of been following it on Twitter with some commentators there. I haven't contributed. I didn't even have a Twitter account. But I've been following some of it, and let me just put it this way. If the US election that we've just seen, if those events had occurred in, take your pick, say the Ukraine or Uganda, or, you know, pick a country outside of the developed West, had they occurred in those places, everyone would have been saying that's fraud. There are severe electoral irregularities, rah, rah, rah. The news media in the West would have been pushing that line. The degree to which they were completely unwilling to even entertain that notion with regard to this recent American election was astounding. And I was watching the coverage of it here. It was in the morning here, and there was that bit where they stopped the recounts and they said there's been a burst water main in Georgia, and at the time I was just like, what the fuck is this? You know, like, obviously this, like, all right, this is how it begins, is it? I was like, you know, what are the chances of there being a burst water main in Atlanta, in the in or near the place where they're doing the vote count? I was like, this is such nonsense. Yeah. And actually I had just done what we call scrutineering, so observing the voting count for local elections. One of my friends ran and asked if I could go to observe the count. So I had just participated in that process here for a local election, and it was very smooth, and each candidate could have their representatives there to observe the count. You're not allowed to touch the ballots or anything like that, but you're allowed to walk around in the hall and observe the various people counting. Yeah, and you could be, you know, they were doing social distancing, but you could be a meter and a half where you could see. And then when there were disputed ballot, you could dispute a ballot. They put them on a separate pile, and then the what's called the returns officer, the person running that particular vote counting area, they would get all of the scrutineers together and say, right, I'm going to check all of these disputed ballots, and would do them in front of us. Did them in front of us, and said, all right, does anyone have any objections? Rah, rah, rah. The whole thing was, you know, and I'm no super huge fan of democracy, but the whole thing was done as you would expect it to be done. Then, you know, 2 weeks later, there's this farcical election in the US. But the way in which the media showed no skepticism at all, absolutely none.
Yeah. And I remember them saying, and we went into this with, I went into this with Black Pilled two nights ago, and it's on BitChute. We talked about the election in some detail, but it's and I said there, it's astonishing how many irregularities there were and how many strange things there were. And it occurred to me that I remember the media going nuts about 6 months ago when Trump said, I'll accept the result. He was basically predicting that there would be electoral fraud going on in this election. And the media went nuts about this. But they themselves had been saying that there was Russian interference in the previous election. So they were saying that it was unpatriotic for Trump to predict electoral fraud in the 2020 election.
Of course.
It's unpatriotic for him to do that. He was casting doubt on the integrity of the electoral system. But they themselves had cast doubt on the integrity of the electoral system 4 years before. Now, obviously, the contradiction is not surprising, but it's just that they get away with it. It's surprising. Again, it's just amazing to me that the hypocrisy, the dishonesty,
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of this is... I mean, it's interesting from sort of the dissident right's point of view, because in a way, we kind of want this to be revealed. So we want the dysfunction to become worse so that it becomes unmistakable. But it is still shocking when it actually happens. The thing that I find most interesting about it, and I've sort of been reflecting upon this week, is that so back whenever Donald Trump was talking about how are they going to try to steal the election. Now, to use an analogy, imagine if I said to you, there's a fox patrolling around outside my chicken coop, and I know the fox wants to eat my chickens. And then I don't lock the door to the chicken coop, and then the fox goes in there and eats the chickens, and then I say, oh, that's really unfair. That's what Donald Trump has done, essentially, that he knew this was going to happen and apparently didn't really do enough to prevent it from happening. Now, maybe he couldn't have prevented it from happening, and that's sort of, that leads to a pretty dark place. But in a sense, I almost believe that you say they're going to steal the election and then they steal the election and they get away with it and you don't really stop them. Because apparently it was more important for him to spend a lot of time on Twitter than actually do anything. And that's, I think that characterizes his entire presidency, actually. He's done very little. But apparently...
And he shouldn't have been on Twitter either. He should have been on Gab.
Yeah. So if they get away with it, then I almost think that he deserves to have had it stolen from him anyway, because he's a fucking dickhead. But, this is sort of where we're at. It's just, we're in complete clown world. And it would be a lot funnier if it weren't so serious, if the implications of all this weren't so serious. But I think we need to pass through this before there's any hope of coming out the other side. And it might be that... in revealing their hand, all of the sort of the quislings on the right, or the so-called right, for instance, the Republican establishment, they will reveal themselves also. And this is a necessary step in a way. It's black-pilled in one sense, but in another sense, it's white-pilled, because those people are controlled opposition, they're gatekeepers and so on. And they need to reveal themselves so that everyone can see these guys are not on our side. And then... there's the possibility, I'm not saying it's a certainty, but there's the possibility of going forwards after that and taking something away from this and building something new. But it is a bitter pill to swallow. And as I said earlier in the talk, in the discussion, if I were in a country outside of the West and sort of didn't, hadn't drunk the Kool-Aid, so to speak, and didn't believe in all the ideology, sort of went along to get along, I'd be saying, wow, the West has really revealed itself to be a paper tiger this year. And if I was sort of vaguely friendly to the US, I'd be thinking, we need to be making new arrangements, because we can't rely upon the old status quo. If I were antagonistic to the US, I'd be thinking, wow, that was a really nice war game that we simulated, and we're in a pretty good position coming out of this.
I just want to intervene on this matter, because a few months ago I decided to watch some old TV shows that I hadn't watched in many years. And one of them was actually Joe 90, which is one of the Thunderbird, the Gerry Anderson productions. And what was interesting about the world, this is just a quick point, don't worry, I won't go on about this too much. What's interesting about that program is it's set in the near future. It was made in 1968, set in like 10, 20 years in the future. And it shows a version of the West, which is idyllic, and everything just works. And there's no corruption, but there's common sense. There are systems in place, and there's common sense in handling those systems. There are facilities. Everything's just great. It's really lovely and nice. Now, by contrast, so that's the West, but all of the villains emerge from the rest of the world, which is depicted in ways that probably nowadays would be regarded as racist and often hilarious, very sort of crass, you know, gruff man with a beard or facial hair, and he's shady, and he's buying weapons to sell to some warlord in a third world country, some dictator. The idea, the sort of world that's depicted there is the rest of the world is corrupt, shady, criminal, dishonest, violent, and unstable, unreliable. Nothing works. The public are lied to all the time. The public are exploited all the time. There's no dignity. And it's a miserable existence. But in the West, we've got it sorted out and everything works. And I think it's interesting to see how that notion of the West was probably quite plausible in 1968. In 2020, it's just gone. I mean, and the US election, with the sheer corruption in the electoral system, but especially in the media, and then the academia, which feeds that. And of course, in high finance, which dictates all of this. And then, of course, in the healthcare systems with COVID-19, and again, a corrupt media there. We are now the public who are being lied to, and everything is now not working. There is just not that sense of stability and integrity that I think used to characterize the West in the middle of. I'm not saying it was ever true. I'm saying that it was plausible. I'm saying that people could believe that about Western civilization up until a few decades ago, up until, I don't know, the 70s maybe. I think that's probably when it was last possible to truly believe in Western civilization here and now, like in the present day. And since then, it's been declining, degenerating. We've come to expect politicians to be corrupt. We've come to expect journalists to lie, but especially over the last 10 years. And then suddenly now this year, you see it come to this awful fruition where people talk about the meme clown world, but it really is.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And this doesn't bode well. I mean, we live in very different parts of the world, and we have our own sets of issues. But the sort of post-American world is not going to be kind to where I am. That we're going to have to contend with the fact that there are 3 or 4 billion people to the north of us, some of whom are more favorably disposed to us than others. And there are only 26 million of us here, in New Zealand, and we're still not even at 30 million people. We're going to have to contend with the collapse of American empire. And unlike, say, Europe, where there are, you have your own sets of issues, certainly, but there are still hundreds of millions of you. And you have much deeper cultures that go back hundreds or even thousands of years. We've only been on this continent for a bit over 200 years. And even simple things like Americans will often ask me, do you do Thanksgiving or Halloween or that kind of stuff? We don't do any of that kind of stuff. We're very much rooted in modernity here in Australia, and we've very much bought into the whole end of history, post-scarcity world and that sort of thing. And the decline of the West, the collapse. I mean, we've seen, I don't know if you're aware of this, but China's actually really been turning the thumb screws on Australia this year in terms of trade, basically killing
whole industries.
Yeah, they've done it to the wine industry, barley. I'm trying to think of the others. There are a whole lot of them, though. And they're really trying to turn the thumb screws on the Australian economy. And there's not much that we can do about that, actually. We've got ourselves into this situation through a combination of aiding and abetting the rise of nations that are not favorably disposed to us, I'll say something about that in a second. And we've made ourselves worse. So they've got better and we've got worse. And I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for people both within the West and outside of the West to deny that when things become more and more dysfunctional here. So we get the tyranny without the sort of we don't get the Lee Kuan Yew version where everything is tightly controlled but functional. We just get the anarcho tyranny. And
get the tyranny without the efficiency.
Yes, that's right. The trains don't run on time. So that's where we're going. And it's shocking and it's a bitter pill to swallow. I think we need to sort of deal with that. Now, the Clayton's choice that we have, though, is that at this point, what it means to support Western capital, Western democracy, all of these things, globo homo, is completely, it's not just antithetical, it wants to exterminate us. And so, on the one hand, if Australia had a war with China, obviously I wouldn't want the Chinese, I don't want to become a Chinese vassal. But on the other hand, what exactly would I be fighting for? I mean, I'm too old to fight, but what exactly would I be fighting for? Globo homo. Well, that's sort of, do you want to be eaten by a lion or a tiger? Do you want to be run over or burnt alive? Whatever. That's sort of where we're at now. That the West, even as you said, sort of from our youth, the West seemed to be something else entirely. It seems like a foreign country now. And this is part of the sort of the immense culture shock that I still deal with. I left Australia in 2007, and I'd actually spent a lot of time outside of Australia prior to that as well. I spent more than half of my adult life living or traveling abroad. And I came back in 2018, so then it was almost 11 years. And it was like one of those sort of comedies where some guy's been locked in a bunker or something and then emerges 50 years later and, all hilarity follows when he doesn't understand the current social norms anymore. It's kind of like that, except it was only a decade. But the West that I'm sort of interested in is basically gone. Aside from our sort of little sphere, nobody reads the old books. Nobody cares about classical music or any of these things anymore. And even the people who sort of consider themselves very cosmopolitan and cultured and so on, they don't know a damn thing about any of these things either. They're very much immersed in whatever was on Netflix last night. That's their culture. Plus sort of, multiculturalism is good and this whole sort of thing. But I think actually in some ways there are white pills to come out of this because we'll have to fight for these things. But, for instance, we can say, well, if multiculturalism is good, then I'm going to have my little culture. I'm going to try to preserve this piece of the West for myself. That's my culture. I'm going to try to preserve that. And you want this sort of bland global monoculture. No, that's not, you talk about diversity. Well, this is my diversity. I'm not going to support globo homo and that sort of thing. But I do think that we need to look at all of this and say, there's no use crying over spilt milk. There's no use sort of pining for how things were in 2019. We need to accept that we're in clown world and to respond accordingly. Otherwise, we are going to lose. And that sort of starts at the personal level and expands outwards and upwards from there. Pardon me. But I think we need to accept that. We need to start thinking as though, no, we don't have power, because clearly we don't have power. When they can openly lie to your face, you don't have power. And we need to stop the sort of like normie con or boomer takes, or however you want to describe them, of, oh, well, you know, we just have to wave the flag or something, and that will solve everything, you know. Like some sort of Alex Jones, you know, this will be not 1776, you know, all this sort of stuff. The way to move forward is to accept that these guys have power over us and respond accordingly, rather than live in this fantasy that, oh, if we just get a vaccine, we'll go back to 2019. We're not going back to that. One way or another, we're going forward. This, either we're going into a dystopian future, or we will come out of this, we will sort of go down into the abyss and we'll come out the other side of the abyss. But we're not going back to 2019 and before. We're not going back to the Francis Fukuyama end of history, it's 1991 and the West has won the Cold War, woohoo, you know, aren't we fantastic? We're not going back to that. So there is kind of a white pill. It's you're living at the end of the Roman Empire and you can lament that, but you're never going back to Tiberius or Marcus Aurelius or any of these guys. But what will emerge from that is what will eventually become the Renaissance and the great glories of Western Europe, exploring the world and making scientific discoveries and composing, you know, Beethoven. This week is the anniversary of his birthday. It's a quarter of a millennium, 250 years since Beethoven was born. Now, obviously, if you're living on the Italian peninsula in the 5th century, it looks pretty bleak. We've got all these guys rampaging across the lands there, and you're the emperor, whomever that happens to be this week, he's completely corrupt and so on and so forth. Everything looks like it's falling in a hole. But, you know, it's a long journey, but eventually you get to the Renaissance. The first step in recognizing that is to recognize that you can't cling to this notion of, oh, you know, the Roman Empire. You can't cling to that anymore. Pardon me. And so that, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but I think that's what we have to take from this year. The mask is off, yeah. And we have to be honest with ourselves, because if we're not going to be honest with ourselves, no one else is going to be.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think you're right that it is time to let go of, you know, the thing that we were all born into, you know, certainly you and me, probably most of our listeners as well. That is that civilization, you know, it ended probably quite a long time ago. But that fact has now become pretty much irrefutable, I would say. What follows will be something else, something different, something separate in many ways. But it doesn't have to be a nightmare. And the loss of the old does not have to negate the validity of the new. I think that's a very important thing to bear in mind as well. Yeah.
It's sad to think of what would be lost, because obviously the collapse of classical civilization, the classical Mediterranean civilization, we don't know what's been lost, actually. We know some of what's been lost because of references to various things in other works, but we don't really know what's been lost. There will be a lot that will be lost. I mean, it's quite plausible that entire, you know, the Louvre could get burnt down, and think of what that would entail, or that Beethoven will lose all of Beethoven's works. And that sounds crazy, but it's quite plausible that these things could happen. And obviously that's going to be horrible, but we can't cry over, say, future spilt milk in that regard, because all we can do is try to preserve these things ourselves. All we can try to do is preserve whatever we think the West is, little pieces. You know, that's all I can do as an individual, and maybe as groups we can do a bit more. But at least we need to acknowledge that and then start doing that. So one of the things I do on my channel is I try to talk about culture in this regard, and I put classical music and artwork and all of that sort of stuff in my videos at the beginning and the end of each video. And I'm trying to get people to say, well, what can I do personally, and maybe in small groups, what can I do to improve myself and to preserve these other things? That's what I really urge people to do, actually. You know, maybe spend less time watching your 700th video about the Great Reset, and maybe spend a little bit more time actually sort of doing meaningful things in this regard.
Yeah, I think it is important because there is only so much lamenting that you can do. And I think it is important to look at your own life and what you can personally contribute to this. But that's probably a topic for another stream. Yeah. So, yeah, let's leave it at that. That's a good hour. And I think it was I hope it was informative for people. I certainly enjoyed it. So any final words before we end?
Well, other than that, just you know, do something meaningful. Don't cry about it. Do something meaningful. That's victory in self-esteem comes from getting points on the board. It doesn't come from saying, "Oh, they're lying to us." Yeah, obviously they're lying to us. But what can you do? Yeah, that's all I'd say.
All right. Okay. Excellent. Well, this was the Franklin on Millennial 2020. So thank you very much for taking part.
And
you're very welcome. I'll be back in about 50 minutes with The Great Order. So, okay, I will see you then. In the meantime, thank you for watching.